I'm Scott, and welcome to Shelfware. This is the first episode, and who better to have on this first episode? We started a podcast, I can't even remember the year now, 2007 or something. SFF Audio, and Jesse has been running that ever since. Every week, once a week, for years on end, and no end in sight.
No end in sight. That sounds bad.
My good friend Jesse Willis, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Yes.
Happy to be here.
That's
happy
great.
To be the first and possibly last guest.
Absolutely. Possibly the very last one. That's right. So, but yeah, we've done a lot of podcasting together.
Mm-hmm. We invented the read-along format as far as I'm
concerned. Yeah, we definitely have done a lot of the read-alongs, which is what, I'm always looking for podcasts that do this kind of thing.
It's pretty rare.
It is rare, which is why I'm doing this one. It's like, you know, you poke around and you look for something, and when you can't find it, that's when you know you should do it.
That's exactly right.
Yep. So yeah, this podcast, I'm planning to do read-alongs. I plan to have friends along and do this once a month. Read a book and talk about it.
So, what a good idea.
Brilliant. But yeah, our first read-along was The Turn of the Screw.
That's
by Henry James, and I remember that really clearly when we recorded that, because SFF Audio before then was, we did a lot of talking about audiobooks and audiobooks that had come in and audiobooks that we're interested in and all this other stuff. And then,
because we are a review site.
That's right. We were a review site, and not so much anymore.
Nope.
But back then, I'm pretty sure it was you who said, hey, let's talk about this story. And we read it, and it was
probably it's because it gets mentioned by Eric Rabkin in one of his lectures, and we reviewed. I know you sent me that those lectures from the teaching company.
Oh yes, Russ Wright. Yep.
And then I read that book, I think, because of what Eric had said about it. So ultimately, it's all Eric's fault.
Well, how cool is that? And then, so yeah, you do the SFF Audio podcast, and then you do Reading Short and Deep with
Eric.
Yes, yes. And I'm the editor for that series. But Eric Rabkin is your podcast partner on that one. Mm-hmm. And it's funny. Yeah, we didn't know him then, did we?
No, we had to get him on the show and talk to him and learn all about his wisdom. And then, gain his confidence and trick him to do a weekly podcast.
And he continues to be tricked
every week.
On a weekly basis.
Speaking of which, I had a show with him earlier today, and guess what we were talking about?
What were you talking about?
A Donald Westlake story.
No kidding. Wow.
Truly.
Yeah, that's great. So on Reading Short and Deep, you do short stories. You talk about short stories. So today you did one by Donald Westlake, which is
his very first.
Yeah, his very first short story.
Indeed, as a professional.
Excellent.
He paid $20 for it.
Wow. Was it science fiction or mystery or crime?
It is a science fiction, which is kind of funny because he's not known for that. The book we're going to talk about is not science fiction. It's called Or Give Me Death. It's first published in Universe Science Fiction, November 1954.
Wow.
Westlake said in a interview I found online, he said, they asked him, what was your first story? How much did you get paid? And he said, my first story was Or Give Me Death. I sold it to Universe Science Fiction. They paid me $20, and then the magazine promptly folded. I checked it out. It actually lasted two more issues, but yes.
Holy cow. How about that?
It didn't last long. And it is it's a pretty terrific story, although it feels a lot different until you start looking a little bit below the surface. Wait, that's a different podcast.
Oh, I love it.
And it's only like 6 pages, something like that, 13 minutes to read. There's a great audiobook version on Audible read by my friend Mike Vendetti.
Oh, great.
And I got to tell you, it's kind of related to the book we're going to talk about.
Because, no kidding. Okay.
And I sent a little tweet earlier today. Well, not that much earlier, in between that podcast and this one. I asked, other than, and I named like 4 stories, I think, or maybe 3 stories. In novels. How many stories in science fiction are about insurance?
Not many.
Right?
Right.
It's not a major topic of conversation, right?
Right.
We got time travel. We got aliens. We got, utopia, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's weird that in the first story by Donald Westlake, you've got a story. There's actually a scene where he talks about insurance. And then I don't know if you noticed it in the book we're going to talk about. What's it called?
Somebody Owes Me Money.
Which is from 1969.
Yeah.
Did you notice what the father was obsessed with?
What was the father obsessed with?
Insurance.
Insurance, right.
He was always like trying to figure out how much insurance he should get and whether it was a good deal. So every time Chet went home,
We
checked in with his dad. He was at the table and he had this is a very Westlake-ism. He's got the ballpoint pen in his hand with the blue, the blue ink. And he brings it up to his forehead and scratches his forehead and gets all these blue lines on his head. Right. Very Westlake-ism. And I was like, well, that's really weird. Westlake talks about insurance in his very first short story. It's not a lot, but he does talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
I'll just read that section if you don't mind.
Okay, yeah, please.
From page 55 of the PDF of Or Give Me Death. And I'll just tell you the premise of this story. It's kind of science fiction. It's called Or Give Me Death, and it's about Patrick Henry, who is a founding father of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And the premise is when it's very Westlake kind of premise. When Patrick Henry gave the speech, "Give me liberty or give me death," someone in the hereafter was listening. And so they gave him liberty instead of death.
Oh, wow.
And so he's still alive in 1954.
Okay. Well, that's awesome.
He's suffered many grievous wounds over the years, including being shot in the head, being torn in the heart. And in 1823, he was shot in the head. And I'm like, what? 1823? What happened in 1823? Eric and I worked it out that independently, I'll tell you, mm-hmm. shows our separate but equal geniuses. 1823 is the Monroe Doctrine, which says, the way I think of it, the Western Hemisphere belongs to the United States.
Right.
Europe, right. Asia, stay out. This is our land.
Yep.
You can do whatever you want in Europe, but this is our place. Don't mm-hmm. come in here. So Patrick Henry was a very weird founding father. He was a governor of, I think, Massachusetts a couple of times. But he has this line, "Give me liberty or give me death." And then he goes on to sort of relate in the story all the problems he finds in the United States today. And then he says this to his doctor. "What's wrong with Social Security and free college educations?" I asked. That's the doctor talking. "They're progressive." Mm-hmm. And then Patrick Henry says, "Progressive? If I told you suicide was progressive, you'd run out and kill yourself. There's nothing wrong with the government insurance, but there's everything wrong with compulsory government insurance and giving everybody college educations. What are most of them going to do with all that pretty knowledge? All they're going to do is be unhappy and all their lives because they've prepared for a better job than the one they got." And so it's like, okay, that's not much about insurance, but it got me to thinking. He also talks about Social Security, all the changes that have happened, right, in the United States since when he was in there at the beginning. And I was like, why is that insurance stuff in this story of somebody owes you money?
Well, yeah,
somebody owes me money.
Right.
I was like, he's very, very subtle, but I remembered that Westlake wrote a very long short story, a short novelette or whatever you call it, called The Risk Profession, which is, again, one of the very first, it's one of the very few insurance stories in science fiction. It's set in outer space. It's about an insurance investigation, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And then Eric pointed out that Lifeline by Heinlein is is an insurance story. That's actually, it turns out that that's actually Heinlein's first published story as well.
That's interesting because as you say that, there's a story by Heinlein called Gentlemen Be Seated, which is about there's a guy who works on the moon who is taking a reporter around. And he's like, he demands extra pay from the guy who brought the reporter to him. He says, yeah, I'll do it, but I need extra pay and all this stuff. And while they're in there, I'm pretty sure they mention insurance, you know, because there's an accident.
Yeah. Yep. It's kind of funny. And so I thought a little bit and I put the question out on Twitter, but I haven't heard a lot of great answers back. There's actually a Paul Kornbluth novel called Preferred Risk, which is also about insurance. But it's a relatively rare phenomenon, but it made me think, you know, you've got a guy who's explicitly political, that is Heinlein. He's got very strong political views. And somebody like Westlake, who I don't think of as at all political. He's sort of anti-political, if you've read some of his stuff,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I agree with that, yeah.
I think he actually, I think there's a secret politics going on inside of Westlake, and I never noticed it before because this is my second read of this book.
Well, yeah. And well, on the thing you just read, what strikes me is that here we are 70 years later and those are the exact arguments we're having.
Right. Right.
That's amazing. Yeah,
it is amazing. And then the thing is the other thing that was weird that connected Heinlein with Westlake, two guys who are really very different. To me, only reason I knew the name Patrick Henry is because of a famous essay that Heinlein wrote in defense of above ground nuclear testing. Huh. And it's called Who Are the Heirs of Patrick Henry? And I'm like, well, that's kind of a weird idea that he's invoking Patrick Henry, this guy famous for give me liberty or give me death. But Heinlein's, you know, he's worried about the Russians, right?
Right, right.
And that actually is in the Or Give Me Death story as well, although it's very subtle. I think Heinlein is completely not subtle.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's like super subtle.
Wow, that's so, something.
Think about the role of the police in somebody owes me money.
Hmm.
You can't trust them.
Yeah, you can't. Right.
They're corrupt.
They are corrupt. They're part of the problem.
And then think about how Chet... or Chester. Chet is very, very different from his dad. His dad's sitting over the books at home, doddering, sort of drawing blue lines on his forehead, waiting for the insurance man to show up, making TV dinners, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And Chet is out there, you know, driving around town, gambling with his poker buddies, reading books. In fact, both of them are into gambling in a certain sense because insurance is gambling.
Yeah, and that's I remember him saying that. He said,
right?
You know, the stock market is the same thing as gambling.
It is.
It is, yeah.
And then
except for the people who know what's going on, you know, who can actually influence
you know, the
that.
House. And think about Abby.
Mm-hmm.
Where does she work?
Right.
Las Vegas.
Yeah, Las Vegas, right. And she knows some tricks, too.
She does.
Right. So let's give everybody a quick grounding if they haven't read the story. In a quick nutshell, Chet Conway is a cab driver. And he's doing his job and picks up a fare and gets ready to drop the guy off. And then the guy gives him a tip on a horse. He goes and he bets on this horse and wins $980, which is one heck of a lot of money. You know, I'm rich, he says. And then he goes back to his bookie to collect that money. And when he walks into his bookie's apartment, he actually gets up there and the door is open. And he walks in there and the fella's been shot dead. And so he calls the police. And while he's talking to the police, the dead man's wife walks in. And the next thing you know, so the rest of the book is him. Somebody owes me money is him. He's owed $980 from somebody because his bookie's dead and he just wants his money. And because he's lurking around wanting his money, the people that actually did the shooting and the dead man's sister named Abby all start to suspect Chet of being the guy who did it. Mm-hmm. And then all this stuff gets intertwined and in an extremely fun way, I might add.
Dude, it's so fun.
It is the
best.
It's
like putting on the most comfy pair of pants you've ever put on.
I love it. Because there's just something about his style that is just so amazing. Good. You can just read it. And just these little things, these observations that he makes. Like, I loved when he said, when the character was introducing himself, it's in first person, and he said, I wrote this down, my eloquence comes from reading rather than from formal education, which limits the kind of jobs open to me. And I thought that was a great statement. It's something that I fight against now in my life and career at the moment. That's a sentence that that's high on my mind all the time. But it's so it's so really true. You know, it's so very true. People that don't have the formal higher education have trouble when it's not the education that they're lacking. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
So. But just these observations like that, you know, and then when he decides whether or not to go and make a bet on this horse, the thing that tips him over and makes him think that he better is because the guy can do odds in his head really fast.
Right.
And
he knows what he's talking
20
about.
20 to 1, he knows exactly immediately what the payoff would be on any amount. He says, hey, anybody who can do that must know what he's talking about.
And later on in the book, he says, all the races are fixed.
Yeah.
So it's like the fix is in, right? This is in fact that theme that the only real way to make money is to be on the inside, right? Yeah. To own the casino. What did the detective, I want to call them Goldbrick, but that's not his name. Goldberg?
I can't recall either.
It's something like that. Mm-hmm. Anyways, he says if my guys had been on the scene and they found the money, there wouldn't have been any question. They would have just divided it amongst themselves, right? So the money was not, maybe it's one of the gangsters who says that, right?
Right,
if the cops had found the money, they would have divided it amongst themselves. We would have no problem with that.
Yeah.
And that's because all the cops are on the take.
Yeah. It reminds me of a story. I went to Las Vegas one time. It had to been at least 15, 20 years ago. And I got in a cab and, was the cab driver's last day. He was retiring and he talked the entire time. And one of the things that he said was when the mob ran this place, stating that it's not the same as it was, right? But when the mob ran this place, there wasn't any crime. You know, because it hurt their bottom line to have someone out there stealing wallets. So he said that they would take care of it. If that happened to a tourist who came in, they'd take care of it, right? But now it was the police that were having to take care of it, and it wasn't near as good. And so it's kind of like they've built this ecosystem where the mob and the cops, they all coexist in this system that seems to be working for everybody that's one of those things. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And then, the people that are outside of that are watching that stuff happen.
Mm-hmm. And then there's the regular folks who don't know what's going on.
Right.
Don't know that they're the people who are playing against Abby, the blackjack dealer who knows a few tricks, but who says we don't need to use these tricks because the house has the edge. Right.
Yeah.
And blackjack. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
They just play the percentage.
If you just play that, you win. The house is always going to have this percentage guaranteed.
The house will always make its cut.
It's always guaranteed.
That's right. Yeah. And so Chet he's both an idiot and also an incredibly savvy guy. He's both brave and he's basically the best first person. That's what he's so good at, Westlake, right? He just gives us, every character in the book has a personality. He's us. We love hanging out with Abby. Sometimes she's the lead in the story, and sometimes he's the lead. It's a very, I was thinking how cinematic it was and how I'm so surprised it hasn't been a movie.
Yeah.
But On the other hand, a lot of it is about those sort of like the hand gestures and the sort of the internal jokes and the internal observations that it's beautiful. But the plot's terrific, too.
Yeah, it really is. It's a murder mystery. Yeah, they could make this movie based in the 50s or based right now.
Yep.
You know, they obviously changed some things for basing it right now, but the plot works.
Doesn't have to change very much.
Nope, not much at all.
You know, cell phones wouldn't be needed that much. You know, looking stuff up on the internet, it's kind of similar. I want to point to an example scene of something that maybe I wouldn't have noticed before to support my thesis.
Go for it. Yeah.
That this is a book all about gambling and insurance, and insurance and gambling being the same thing. In essence, remember when they need to fill up the car with gas?
Yeah. Yeah.
Chet says, I want you to, he doesn't say, I want you to go to a specific gas station, but he mentions the name of a particular gas station because they have some sort of gambling contest that the more money you put into it, the more times you visit the gas station, the better your chances of winning are.
Right. Right.
Mm-hmm. And there's a similar scene where he calls into like a local, corner store, and he puts his number in, right? He pays 25 cents, and I don't know if it's outside the New York, but something they used to have. They just called it the numbers racket, where the local gangsters would have a number between 1 and 1,000 or something like that. And you pay every month or every week your number, and if your number comes up, then you get the pot, right? The big pot of everything. And so even though he's on the run from the cops, on the run from killers, he makes sure to, you know, always get his gambling in.
Yeah. Yeah.
And who's the romantic figure that he's hanging out with? It's a lady who gambles on the other side, right?
Yeah. Right. Right.
It's fun stuff.
That is funny. And you're describing the lottery. I don't know. I assume you know about the lottery in the United States. They have that in Canada?
Yeah, we have a provincial lottery.
Okay.
But no, this is an illegal lottery.
Yeah, right. But it's the same thing. It's just funny.
Yes.
You know, getting people to give you money for very low odds. Yeah.
You pay a dollar and you can win a million, right?
It's voluntary taxation.
It is voluntary taxation, indeed. Mm-hmm. And this brings me to my bigger thesis, which I was going to say. I tried to do as much research as I can. Like I like to think about the books that I'm reading. And normally when I read Westlake, I just enjoy. That's how I got into him. I just enjoyed reading the books.
And that's how
I was
too,
like,
with
why
him.
Is he so good? Like, because it feels like it's insubstantial, that it's not about anything. It's just about the little ride that you're having. It's like putting on a comfortable pair of pants. But I think he actually is like imparting wisdom in a certain sense. So one argument I heard, really interesting argument, I can't remember where I got it. I tried to look it up. It didn't come up. But basically the argument was that if you want to understand what government is for, government is an insurance company. So the idea is you have borders, right, around your country that prevent the barbarians from coming in and taking all your stuff and killing you and enslaving you. So you have the army for that, right? And then inside the country, you have cities, and between the cities are roads. And those roads can be patrolled by bandits. So you have the highway patrol. And their job is to ensure that you are not attacked on the highways and have your stuff stolen from you. Similarly, in some countries, not all countries, but every country that's a first world country in the entire planet, except for the United States, government takes care of healthcare because it's a kind of insurance. You don't know if you're going to get cancer. You don't know, if you're going to hit by a car, but you want to have that taken care of, and you don't want to not be able to pay for it. So you have health insurance. And in places like a lot of Canada, even like car insurance is a monopoly of the province. So in British Columbia, I can have my choice of one insurance company for insuring my automobile. And in some cases, it's treated like a nonprofit in some provinces. And in other provinces, it's like a voluntary tax, right?
Yeah.
So having the monopoly, you can have the insurance company working in your favor, or you can have the insurance company chiseling you. You can have the insurance company be a community that, you know, goes on GoFundMe and gives you how much they think you deserve, or you can buy external insurance. And in the world of Chet's world, right, where his dad is trying to figure out the numbers, spending all his time, you know, scribbling on his forehead and working the numbers out very carefully, waiting for the insurance man to come up and explain some aspect of the insurance that he's trying to calculate. You've also got Chet, who is sort of wildly foolish about where he gambles. At the beginning of the story, he owes a lot of money to a lot of people, and yeah, that's why he's so excited. Mm-hmm. And he says, I can work more hours to pay off my debts. And then the first guy we meet him getting paid, you know, a tip, it's not a real tip. It's a tip on a horse, which is even more gambling.
Right.
So there is a message underneath all of this fluff. It's just so smooth. He's like, if he was a doctor, you know, he'd say, well, you know, you've got a terrible stage 5 cancer. However, when you walk out of the hospital room, you know, walk out of the doctor's office, you're feeling great because he made you feel like nothing was wrong.
Yeah.
Even though, because, you know, everything's going to be all right because you're hanging out with Donald Westlake's dialogue. Right, it's just so wonderful.
That is cool. You know, and I think that, you know, for me, you know, the books that I've read by him, you know, were things like The Hot Rock, which is a Dortmunder heist book, and The Axe, which we read together on the SFF audio podcast, and this one. And, you know, I don't think I've read any Parker's yet.
They're similar, but different.
But different. Okay. Yeah. And what strikes me about him is he is imparting wisdom, you know, so it's cool. You know, you're thinking of this higher level thing, and I can't argue that at all. Because it's basically the reality of what this main character is and how real he is and his concerns in life and his addictions and his desires, right? And the things that go right and the things that go wrong are just so real and truthful, you know?
Honest.
And, right, very, very honest. And also, there's just this style. It's like he's not, I was going to say afraid, but I don't even know if that's the right word, but he just writes with this confidence that, you know, all the dialogue is excellent, like you said, but there's these things that happen, you know, in between things that are happening and what those things are is wisdom, right? He's saying things, you know, like just a sentence that says, I got my education by reading books and I don't have an education. You know, that's a societal statement,
absolutely.
You know, in a sentence that this guy just thinks, you know, and you know, a man who can do numbers fast at his head has got to know what he's doing, you know, I mean, and that again, you know, you just take that sentence alone and you know, there's all kinds of conspiracy stuff that can come out of there. It just means a whole lot. And it's the kind of things that I hear people say all the time without really thinking about what it could mean. Yeah. And then he just has a line that I wrote down that just made me laugh out loud was, you know, I sat up and the room was full of a man with a gun.
Right.
You know, so he says,
so many,
you know, so he's got this, like, you know, I think that that's, you know, something that Joss Whedon always tries to do is say things in a witty way. But I think that Westlake has wisdom.
He does.
And it's what's in between the events of the plot where this stuff comes out.
I don't know the timeline on this, but it's pretty interesting. So one of the things you'll notice after if you read a lot of Westlake, which I highly recommend everybody do, is that he seems to draw from his own experience a lot of the times. You know, he's the kind of guy like Lawrence Block who would, you know, I need a paycheck. He doesn't get in the cab and drive around town picking up people all night. Instead, he goes into the office and he writes the whole novel in the weekend.
Right? Yeah,
he just sits there and types until it's done, and then if he needs, like Parker, when Parker runs out of money, he just goes and pulls another job. Right. Mm.
When so Parker's a thief or a
yes, okay. Parker's a heister, right?
Heister, so yeah, okay.
he robs not so much banks as armored cars.
I love a good heist story.
Oh yeah, and the great thing about those stories is the heists usually are quite smooth. It's the criminals that you're hanging out with are the problem, right?
Right, right.
The people you have to consort with as a criminal. And so the way Westlake wrote the Parker books under the Richard Stark pseudonym is he's a comedian. That is to say, Westlake's a comedian. Mm-hmm. So he instead of playing it for laughs, he just put the situations in the funny situation. So he's just finished robbing a theater or something, right? And he's in the getaway car, and then he's on the side of the road fixing the tire. And he has no tire iron, right? So it's like a difficult situation. It's a comedic situation,
yeah.
But Parker isn't laughing. We're appreciating it. We're not laughing at any jokes, but we appreciate the cosmic irony of the situation, right?
That's interesting. So you say Parker isn't laughing. Parker's
no,
a serious.
Parker never laughs.
Okay.
Exactly. Parker is a shark. He's he's always on the move. He needs to keep moving. He has later on. He has a wife and stuff like that. But the first book's the worst book in that series. But the important part is if you look at there's two sort of main series that Westlake wrote. One is the Parker books, they're very famous, lots of movie adaptations. Mm-hmm. And then there's the Dortmunder series, and there's lots of books and lots of movie adaptations. And they are actually the same kinds of stories, but the Parker novels are noir or noir-ish. I would say hard-boiled is better to understand it. And then the Dortmunders are comic capers. And Westlake was a man from New York, lived in that area. He would move to Florida, in the winter times. He would go on vacation to Cuba or whatever. He would go all sorts of different places, but he wrote about his own neighborhood. He wrote about the kinds of people he hung out with, and the kinds of people you see, like as a main character. You would have a character in a novel be just out of the army, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or more often, you would have a guy just out of the Air Force. And guess what Westlake did? He went into the Air Force. He was an MP, and he did that for a couple of years, and he came back with a love of Dortmunder beer. So, right.
How about that?
And, and then in this book, I did not get the timing on this, but I did do a little research. I was remembering that Westlake, he was married a couple of times at least, but his final wife was a woman named Abby Adams.
Oh, okay.
Abigail Adams.
Yeah. How about that?
Right.
Yep.
He's drawing from his own life is what I'm saying. So
right.
I assume hanging out with Westlake, I've seen him interviewed. He's very witty. He's very, very dry with his jokes and his speeches and such when you see him interviewed. Mm-hmm. He doesn't laugh at his own jokes, but they're very laugh-worthy. He is his characters. He's just like that. He loves the observations that he makes about how their hands are moving.
Yeah.
There's a liverwurst sandwich that gets pointed at people like a gun in this story.
That's too funny. Yep.
There's a lot of the lady crawling over him while chat while he's in bed. He's very, 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 very funny, and he's dry. He doesn't make jokes. It's observational delight.
Yeah, I liked. There's a lot of that comedy comes out where the guy. The main character is shot in the head, but he's grazed in the head. So he's dealing with that for part of the book. And Abby, who's the female character, she's helping him through that, you know, and that's funny stuff. And then they end up having to kind of shelter in a room together and, you know, being in bed together, but nothing happening. Yeah, that's all good stuff.
Yeah.
And then I did laugh out loud at the very end. So first of all, how did you like the resolution of the mystery that they were trying to solve? Is like, you know, well, who shot me, you know?
It's basically given away on the last page, right?
Right, exactly, exactly. But I laughed out loud because here's a lady who killed the original guy, the bookie, mm-hmm. at the beginning of the book. Mm-hmm. And basically she gets off because she joined a convent. You know, they decide not to go after her. And I had to laugh because they said, is this punishment enough? Like, oh man. Well, Abby says, for me it is. For me it would be. But yeah, I mean, that was her brother that got killed, so I thought that was kind of funny.
She the alternative book we were gonna do, right?
Mm-hmm.
Instead of this book.
Yeah.
Brothers Keepers. Still want to read it.
Yep, I still got it.
Mm-hmm. I gotta definitely get a hold of that audiobook version of it.
I have two Westlakes on deck. I have that one, and then I have The Hunter by Richard Stark on audio that I haven't read yet.
I don't know if he was Catholic, but there's a theme there. Mm-hmm. He gets the lady going into the convent. He has the one that's set in a monastery in New York, right?
Yep, yep.
And there's even a Parker novel called The Mourner, and it's about a little statuette. I think it might have been raised Catholic.
Yeah, I'm guessing so, but I guess I don't know for sure. It feels like it.
Yeah. And he's reacting to it. He's a very thoughtful guy. Probably was educated by Jesuits who gave him stern lectures.
Very possible. I don't know for sure, but possible.
And then recommended that he go into the priesthood.
Right.
Because Westlake is—he is obviously incredibly intelligent, but he never lords that fact over anybody.
No,
right?
No,
it's the opposite.
Yeah,
it's all about the appreciation. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, the most minor of characters always gets their full due. Think of how much attention is given to the detective's wife. She's just a problem for them to get by, right? They don't want to let her know that the husband's lying on the floor of this very well-appointed color television basement, right? That's way too expensive for a cop's salary. That he's been conked on the head down there, so they have to sneak by her. And they don't even see her, but they hear her humming to herself like one would when stuffing a turkey,
right? Yeah,
taking on a long-term project, a couple of hours project. Even when they're not present, the characters in a Westlake story always get attention that would never occur to anyone. Like else, no one I know who writes books pays attention to minor characters the way Westlake does. It's just weird. Like it's beautiful. In fact,
it is beautiful. I totally enjoy that. Yeah, absolutely. So I looked it up while you were talking, and Donald E. This is from the Westlake Review, a blog.
Yeah, a great website.
Yeah, Donald E. Westlake was born a Catholic, raised a Catholic, schooled a Catholic. And for all I know, he died a Catholic. But if you're going to get persnickety about it, he was a lapsed Catholic for most of his life because two divorces is precisely two more than a practicing Catholic is ever allotted. So, yeah.
That's good stuff.
That is really good stuff. Well written. But yeah, so, yep. So he wrote a book called Good Behavior, which... The review for a book called Good Behavior is where that paragraph was from.
Oh, that's great.
And it looks very Catholic to me from the images that are there. So, wow. It even quotes St. Teresa of Avila up here from the interior castle.
It's number 6 in the Westlake Dortmunder series.
Oh, is it? Oh, that's cool. Mm-hmm. Okay. What, are they going to heist a church of some type?
It says John Dortmunder's one of the slyest burglars going, but by God, he has bad luck. While fleeing the police during his latest caper, he falls through the roof of the Silent Sisterhood of St. Philomena. Told us it's a lap of trouble. It's an act of God, the sisters exclaim. Only the Creator himself could have sent this criminal just when they need him. Sure, they'll shelter him for the cops, but there's a price. He must help them retrieve their youngest and newest member of their from her father's clutches. This promises to get sticky.
Oh, that's awesome. That's great.
Right?
Yeah.
I haven't read that one.
I love it. I haven't either, but the Hot Rock was so good that I can't believe I haven't continued yet, because I love heists and I love Westlake, and that was a great book. And I don't know how many Dortmunders there are, but that's definitely a series. I should be reading one every few months. 10,
probably 12 or more. Mm-hmm. Could be 20.
Yeah.
It's hard to keep track. And you don't really need to read them in order. Just, I would get them as I could.
Yeah.
They never, they never fail.
Right. He's written so many books too.
And they never fail. Sometimes there's ones that are better than others, but they never, ever fail. And his attention, and his interest in so many things, like one of the first, maybe the only Parker we've done on SFF Audio's podcast is the second book in the series called The Man with a Getaway Face.
Mm.
And it's about, Parker getting out of a sticky situation. But the minor characters, there's this doctor who once was involved with the Communist Party, and now he operates this illegal plastic surgery place for the mob, right? Mm-hmm. And there's this union organizer who got hit on the head a long time ago, and now he don't think so good, but he's a driver, and he's still loyal to the party, whatever that means, because he's been hit so bad. And Parker doesn't care about any of that stuff. He doesn't care about communism or anything like that. He just wants the money. But Westlake does. Westlake cares about all of this stuff.
Mm, yeah. Yeah.
And he wrote a book called Humans. Very weird book. And it's about a firefighter from the Chernobyl nuclear disaster. Basically touring the United States. It's been a long time since I read it.
Wow.
And the angels were watching out over him and thinking about what's going on. It's such a weird idea for a book. But when Westlake has an idea, he pulls it off. He just somehow, even though it's not a great novel in the sense, like this one is, it's snappy, right? It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. You love the beginning, you love the middle, you love the end. It's technically it's a murder mystery. It's if it was a movie, it would be a romantic comedy, right? Romantic comedy, murder mystery. It has all sorts of action and adventure stuff. But it's also like a delight. And even when he's taking it on a very weird subject, he just is so thoughtful about it that it becomes impossible not to be interested in it the way he's interested in it. And that's, he make a great teacher, because whatever he's talking to you about, he's passionate about it,
but he
also is lecturing you about it.
Mm-hmm.
He's just showing you.
Yeah, that's cool. Amazing. Yeah, it is amazing. Yeah, it's a gift.
We're lucky to have him. And I was telling Eric, he said, well, you talk a lot about this Westlake guy. And he says, I haven't read very much. And I said, oh, lucky you. Because if you haven't read a lot of Westlake yet, you're just... You have so much to look forward to.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I love that.
And I have a lot to look forward to, for sure.
I want to savor the few that I haven't read that are left.
That's cool.
I know they're going to be good.
Yeah. And he's written a bunch of books. This one has an interesting publication story to it. So it looks like, according to, I'm on donaldwestlake.com. Mm-hmm.
His first
novel was The Mercenaries, which is also known as The Cutie.
Yep.
In 1960. And then that was republished by Hard Case Crime recently, I believe, right?
It was, as The Cutie.
Yeah. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, about 11th.
Got The Operator, I think, was the third title for that one. Well, I actually had both of those.
Cool.
I didn't realize that they were the same book until I started reading the second one. I'm like, oh, damn it. I read there this it one. Is.
Gotcha. So Somebody Owes Me Money is interesting because it was published in hardcover, and then it was published in Playboy magazine in its entirety, I believe.
Yeah.
It's not a super long novel, but over two issues of Playboy magazine. And then they never released a paperback.
What?
In the United States anyway, until Hard Case Crime did it.
Wow.
It was like an oversight by somebody or something. I don't know.
That's weird. But, in the introduction to Playboy, there's a great illustration showing the dead man, the horse racing, the cab. Mm-hmm. And then it says, when you get involved with winning a long shot, a dead bookie, his beautiful sister, and assorted mobster types, the payoff has got to spell trouble. And I did a tweet earlier this week when I started reading this book. I was just so much enjoying it. And I made a whole bunch of metaphors in the one thing, basically saying, you know, if you want to gamble some of your time, a sure bet is Donald Westlake, Somebody owes Me Money. And it's absolutely true. There's no gambling here.
Yeah.
If you pays your money for a Westlake book, you get paid.
Mm-hmm.
I want to tell you a really cool fact. There is a Parker novel that crosses over with the Dortmunder novels.
Oh, really?
Did I ever tell you?
No,
no. It's really, it's a funny, very funny situation. It's called Jimmy the Kid.
Uh-huh.
And Jimmy the Kid is a book about, it's a kidnapping book. So Dortmunder is tasked with kidnapping somebody for some reason, and he doesn't want to do it. But some other person says, no, I have the recipe. And he pulls out a Richard Stark novel that he was reading in prison called Child Heist,
uh-huh,
in which Park robs, kidnaps a kid for money. And sprinkled throughout the Dortmunder novel are chapters from this fictional Richard Stark novel called Jimmy the Kid. There is actually a film adaptation, although I wouldn't recommend it very much. It's as meta as you can get because it's two of Westlake's, you know, iconic character series crossing over with each other. And he's making fun of his own book and also making fun of his characters who are using this book as a guideline.
That's hilarious.
Right?
Yeah.
And, you know, you read The Hook, right?
Yep, The Hook, right.
And that's a book about a writer who needs to find a way back into writing success, right?
Right, right.
He writes what he knows.
Yeah, yeah.
In the spin-off series for the Parker, there's a character named Grofield, when we meet him in the Parker series, he's a fun character. He's a heister, but he's trustworthy, but he's got a major character flaw,
mm-hmm,
and that's that he's an actor. And he's incredibly handsome, but not the kind of handsome Hollywood likes. Hmm. So he works in summer stock, and in the winter, he's a heister. Parker appreciates that he's reliable, but doesn't like all the theatrics that he puts in. And wow, there's three spinoffs of those,
mm-hmm,
and they're delightful. It's like a TV show spinoff where you're hanging out with the other character.
Yeah, that's awesome.
You gotta love that stuff.
Yeah, oh, I do love it.
It's his own universe, really.
Yeah, for sure.
Oh, I wanted to tell you another thing about this book. I don't know if I ever told you this, because I do talk about Westlake a lot.
Mm-hmm.
This book, I would classify it, and I'm pretty sure Trent Reynolds, who ran the Violent World of Parker blog, and he may be involved in that Westlake Review site too. I can't remember.
Okay.
I think he might have been the one to point this to me, but there's a kind of genre novel that he sort of invented, and this one sort of falls into it. I think they call them the nephew novels.
The nephew and the novels,
reason,
huh?
Yeah, and the reason is there's this guy, and he's not really a criminal, but his uncle is. And so the problems that he gets into are not because he's a horrible monster, but rather just the circumstances of his life. You know, he's just trying to make his way in the world where everybody's corrupt, and he's a happy-go-lucky guy, but unfortunately, these things happen, right?
That's right.
And so this, I think, qualifies as a nephew novel, although the nephew here is actually a niece in a certain sense. And there's a lot of these. There's at least, I would say, a dozen books like this.
That's cool.
Standalone.
The nephew novels.
Nephew novels. I think that's what they're called.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a formal genre as far as I know, but if we look around online, we should be able to find a list of them. And it's so cool that a guy who started off as a science fiction writer and had so much promise on it. We just did that Anarchia show, right?
Yep, right.
A guy who's bursting with ideas, found a way to make a living, not doing what his first love was exactly, but doing something that I think is just amazing. He's one of, it's, you know, if I made a list, and I haven't ever done it, you know, my favorite writers, he would be right up near the top, if not at the top. It's hard to, like, I love a lot of different writers. I love Jack London. I love Robert Heinlein. Block.
Yeah.
Westlake's got to be Westlake so near the top.
One of mine, too, and I still haven't read any of them or enough of them. I've read maybe half a dozen now. But now I'm far enough in to where I think, I'd really like to read a Westlake.
You got to do it.
Yep.
It makes your life better because you like... You're communing with a wise person who's entertaining you, and you're enjoying the heck out of it, and it does not feel like work at all. In seeing it the second time, is how cinematic it is. I could go the rest of my life never watching a film adaptation and be perfectly fine with it, because Westlake's voice made it as real as... I see that bar in that basement, right? I see that old, what was an old fashioned, what was that? Sidecar.
Right. The sidecar. Yeah.
And I see him making it. Right.
Oh, that was so funny. He's like, okay, I'll make you one, and has to go upstairs to get stuff. And, and he makes a good one. No less.
And we don't know at that point that he is a bad guy.
Yep.
Right.
Oh, that's right.
We're guessing throughout the whole story who the murderer is.
Right. Right. And
we're guessing wrong the whole way.
Yep.
Brilliant. People sometimes call him a detective novelist, you know, like a mystery novelist. I think that's not correct. I think he is, although he technically did write those, and this one is a murder mystery, amateur detective sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
It's his own genre, really. It's crime as sort of the outside, but he's talking about all sorts of stuff.
Well, I admire your enthusiasm, as always. It's like, you know, I've known you since, 2002 or something, going on 20 years, and I have never known you not to be enthusiastic about books.
There's lots of good ones to read.
That's for sure. So thank you so much for being on here. And couldn't think of a better first guest. I really appreciate it.
I really appreciate you having me on. I look forward to hearing the next one.
Sounds good. Well, thank you much.
I'm trying to give you a whole bunch of like catchphrases. I'm looking forward to hearing the next. Let's wear out that shelf.
I love it. Wear that shelf right out. Too good.